Every once in a while, a case comes out that really makes you scratch your head. Well, I'm scratching my head with both hands on this one. It's time for Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar on Broadcast Blue.
Bringing you the latest case law updates on the legal aspects of law enforcement. This is Broadcast Blue.
Welcome to this edition of Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar. I'm your host, Bruce Allen Barnard. Today I'm covering a case I'm going to call the case of the show and tell entries. This case of the week for our 14th edition of 2018 of Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday, it's a civil case from the 11th Circuit. The case name is Montanez versus Carbajal, and the decision in this case was released on May 9th of 2018. Let me tell you what this case is about. The events in this case took place in Volusia County, Florida. That's just south of me, a couple counties south of me anyway. If you've ever been to Daytona Beach, then you've been to Volusia County. It goes inland as well towards Orlando on I-4. And the facts in this particular case took place near DeLand, Florida, if you're familiar with that. So we have the county sheriff, Volusia County Sheriff's Department involved. It was a springtime afternoon in 2011. Deputy Rabel of the Volusia County Sheriff's Office was in an unmarked patrol car, and he's driving through a neighborhood in DeLand. This particular neighborhood had experienced a significant increase in daytime burglaries. So there was a what the court referred to as a rash of daytime burglaries taking place in this particular DeLand neighborhood. And Deputy Rabel himself was a property crimes investigator. So his purpose out there in the unmarked patrol car is to try and spot these property crimes. When he was driving by a residence at 1127 West New York Avenue, and if you are watching the video or joining me live with the webinar, you're actually seeing the residence on your screen right now. Now, the front of the residence is on the resident fronts on New York Avenue, but there's also a side street going down. It's a corner lot, and if you can see, if you're watching, you can see the street over on the left. That's the side street that will be referred to in a minute. You can also see it where the green arrow is here on this this photograph of the property. So the front of the property is on West New York Avenue. When he drives by, he takes note there's a man standing there, later identified as William Rivera. And he's standing on the sidewalk in front of this residence, about where the green arrow is right now. And he appeared to be, according to the deputy, appeared to be looking around nervously while he's talking on his cell phone. Deputy Rabel said that Rivera seemed nervous, seemed anxious, and he kind of hunched as he paced up and down in front of the house. And then Rivera went to the side of the house and went down the side street. And he, as you can see on the green arrow, if you're watching the video right now, you can see he went down the side street, and then he came to a point down behind the house, towards the back of the dwelling. And as Rivera approached the back door, he saw another person he later identified as Troy Copeland that was huddling nearby. Now, he's been doing this a while, and based on his experience, Deputy Rabel was convinced that Copeland was positioning himself to act as a lookout while Rivera broke into the house. And given everything that he had seen, Rabel radioed for backup. He described the situation as a burglary in process. In a patrol car, a marked car, Officer Carbajal heard and responded to Deputy Rabel's request for backup, and they met at a nearby gas station. It's actually just down, if you're watching down here where you see the green arrow all the way over on the right, where the gas station is, and they quickly formulated a plan for approaching these two suspects. And so after they had the discussion, they both returned to the house. Rivera and Copeland were still standing back there near the back door. Rabel parks his car, and he exited the automobile with his weapon drawn, and Carvajal soon joined Rabel and drew his weapon as well, and the two officers ordered Rivera and Copeland to the ground, where they placed them in handcuffs. So once Rivera and Copeland were cuffed, Deputy Rabel entered the home's back door and stepped through a small, what the court describes as a vestibule area, to a second door. It was the second door was the point that actually led into the home's interior. So there's this outer area. There's two doors, and what we would call up in New England, we would call that a mudroom. But so you have this outer area that you come into first, and then you come through the inner door into the house proper. The interior door was slightly ajar, and he didn't cross the threshold to the inner door, but he leaned through this door and shouted, "Sheriff's office, come out if anybody's in there, sheriff's office." And he heard no answer after about 10 seconds, and so he went back outside. Now, this is the first of seven entries that are made into the house. There were a total of seven entries. The first six entries are made without a warrant, and the seventh entry is made with the warrant. So after this first entry, they go back. Deputy Rabel goes back outside. Officers, Deputy Rabel and Carvajal, then search Rivera and Copeland, and then they find out that Rivera has two kitchen knives in his pants pockets. Now, this is significant. It was significant to Deputy Rabel because when he went in up to the door near the handle on the back door, the first door that he went into, he observed pry marks on the door, which he believed to be fresh pry marks, and they seemed to be consistent with having been made by knives. And so then he finds two kitchen knives in the pocket of this person. The officers asked Rivera and Copeland for identification, and they both presented identification, but neither one of their identification listed this address as their residence, where they lived. This 1127 West New York Avenue was not listed as their address. So combined with the fact that they had these indications that the back door had recently been pried open by tools resembling knives, and he found knives on Rivera, and each of their IDs listed a different address that wasn't the one that they were found in front of, the deputies concluded that they had interrupted an ongoing burglary, and at that point, they formally arrested Rivera and Copeland. So additional officers were called. They soon arrived on the scene. Once they gathered, there were five of them. They said the court said insufficient number. There were five that were there. Officer Carvajal entered the home's main structure, the main area, through that inner door, along with Officer Bainbridge, Hart, and Rodriguez, to check for additional perpetrators or potential victims. And that's what they're saying here. They're looking for these potential victims and additional perpetrators that are inside the dwelling. So the second entry they went in through that inner door into the home's interior. Now, the officers described this as a sweep, which envisions concepts of the protective sweep, which the district court relied on. We'll talk about that in just a minute. But they said the purpose of this was to sweep and look for additional perpetrators or potential victims because they believed a burglary was in progress or had been committed. This second entry lasted for about 4 minutes. Now, this is very important. During the second entry, the first time, remember, Deputy Rabel only went into that first area and just kind of yelled through the cracked door. This time they actually went in to the inner area of the house. And when they did, sitting in plain sight, they saw what they believed to be marijuana as well as drug paraphernalia. They didn't seize anything. They observed it. And so they leave again. So that's the second entry. Almost immediately after they come out, I call this the case of the show and tell. They come out and they tell the supervisor, their supervisor, Lieutenant Henderson, what they had observed, and they went back in the house. So entry number three, they go back in again into the house to show the supervisor the marijuana and the paraphernalia. And after the supervisor saw this contraband, what he suspected as contraband, he called the West Volusia Narcotics Task Force to determine whether a search warrant should be obtained for the rest of the house. And they leave. And there's a fourth entry. Lieutenant Henderson, Carvajal, Bainbridge, and Hart re-entered the house one more time for a fourth time, and they only stayed in the House for about 2 minutes. There's no mention in the record as to what the purpose of the fourth entry was for. Entry number five came half an hour later when Montanez's mother, the plaintiff in this case, one of the plaintiffs in this case, and co-owner of the house, showed up and was escorted inside by Lieutenant Henderson. There's no indication it was consensual. It sounds like, in the way the court treated it, was is they went in escorting her inside on this fifth entry. And then after that entry, an hour after that entry, we have our sixth warrantless entry when the Narcotics Task Force investigators Clay and McNamara arrive. They go into the home with Deputy Rabel to view their marijuana and the drug paraphernalia. So based on the contraband shown to him during that sixth entry, Detective Narcotics Task Force Investigator McNamara swore out an affidavit in support of a search warrant, which the assistant state attorney approved and a circuit court judge signed off on. And so they went back for entry number seven with a warrant. And with warrant in hand, they went back and they subsequently conducted a full search of the house, which revealed $18,500 in U.S. currency, as well as miscellaneous drugs and paraphernalia. So there you go. Now, the authorities, as it turns out, the authorities never filed any charges against any of these three individuals, Rivera, Copeland, or Montanez, pertaining to the drugs. They couldn't figure out who the drugs belonged to. It's one of those constructive possession issues, right? If you don't have actual possession, you have to prove constructive possession. And although they found it in the house, it's occupied by a number of people. They couldn't figure out who it belonged to. Also, ironically enough, the two individuals who were first spotted were actually residing in the house at the time. They resided at the time. Of course, officers didn't know that when they were being observed, but they actually resided in the house along with Montanez and Montanez's mother. So no charges were ever brought. You know what's going to happen now. The three people, the folks who were arrested, and then the two who were arrested, Rivera and Copeland, and then Montanez, the person who owned the property and who's argued Fourth Amendment rights were violated. They sued the officers in state court. The officers removed the case to federal court, and then Rivera, Copeland, and Montanez filed a multi-count amended complaint that alleged both state tort claims and the federal claim under Title 42 of the United States Code, Section 1983, and they made Fourth Amendment violation claims. Rivera and Copeland brought an unreasonable seizure, false arrest claims against Deputy Rabel, and Montanez brought an unlawful entry and unreasonable search claims against all of the officers. The district court dismissed the state law and false arrest claims at the pleading stage, so those went away fairly quickly. And then the officers moved for summary judgment on the basis of qualified immunity for the Fourth Amendment violations under 42 U.S.C. 1983. Now, the district court granted Rabel summary judgment on Rivera and Copeland's claims arising out of their arrest. But at the trial court level, he denied their motion for summary judgment on for Montanez on his claims arising out of those multiple searches, those six searches of his house. And if you read the district court opinion, the district court judge, Paul Byron, in the Middle District of Florida, where I used to practice, I was admitted to the Middle District of Florida. The Middle District of Florida stretches across the center of the state. It goes from Jacksonville down to Orlando and all the way to Tampa. It's a big swath that cuts at an angle. And this was particularly, the case was heard, I believe, in Orlando. But the district court judge, he applied Maryland versus Bowie. Remember, the officer said that the reason they went into the house was to sweep for perpetrators or victims. And they really focused on the term sweep, at least at the district court level. And so much of the discussion of the district court is focused on Maryland versus Bowie. And if you recall the protective sweep, what we call a Bowie sweep, from that, it's a JRE, a judicially recognized exception. And he also classified the Bowie sweep as an exigent circumstance, which is kind of weird. But the Bowie sweep, as you know, typically the Bowie sweep applies to effectuating arrest inside a house. So, and more often than not, you're in there on a warrant. But sometimes, you know, some of the district courts of some of the circuits have held that the buoy sweep can apply outside of arrest that's made immediately outside of a house as well. But you know, you get, when you do a, when you make an arrest inside a dwelling, you get an automatic protective sweep of the areas adjacent to arrest. But in order to look into an area further outside of the area of arrest, adjacent, outside of that, at those adjacent areas, you have to articulate reasonable suspicion that there is someone else present in the dwelling that presents a danger to you. And so much of the district court's opinion was based on the fact that there was no reasonable suspicion to extend a protective sweep into the house. It was totally focused on Maryland v. Bowie. That was the only JRE that the district court looked at. And the court, the district court recognized that all six warrantless entries were searches under the Fourth Amendment, but none of them, and none of them was there the requisite reasonable suspicion to support an extended buoy sweep after making the arrest. And the court also pointed out that the arrest didn't even take place until after the first entry. The person came back. I mean, they didn't search and find the knives on the individual until after the first entry had been made. And they go through, the court goes through a bunch of emergency exigency cases, but doesn't apply them. So the district court didn't apply the concept of an emergency emergency exigency at that particular point. So that's what happens. We're going up. There's an appeal, the officer's appeal. The district court says, hey, we're going to give you qualified immunity for the arrest, but not those entries. Let's take a look at the issues presented now. The first issue is where the court on appeal, the court separated these cases. Were the first two warrantless entries justified under the exigent circumstances doctrine? And then the second question, were the subsequent four entries a warrantless entries a violation of the Fourth Amendment? So that's the, this has gone up on appeal. It's an interlocutory appeal on the district court's denial of the summary judgment. Rabel's 10-second entry announcing police presence in the ensuing four-minute sweep of the house, and then moving on. The officers argued that the argument by the officers arguing for qualified immunity, and remember, they're the defendants in a civil suit. Their argument were that the first two entries in the house were justified by exigent circumstances, or at the very least, that there was no binding precedent that it was clearly established for the purposes of qualified immunity. And then they said that this is the argument they made on the subsequent four. The officer's argument was, if the first two entries were lawful, then the remaining entries to observe the marijuana and associated paraphernalia spotted in plain view during the second entry were also permissible on the grounds that they did not violate any surviving privacy interest. Let's take a look at a couple blasts from the past here. Pearson v. Callahan, a case we've talked about considerable number of times before. Whenever you're talking about qualified immunity, this case is probably going to pop up. So in order to defeat the claim of qualified immunity, the plaintiff in the civil suit has to show that the officers violated a constitutionally protected right or a federally protected right, and that those rights were clearly established at the time of the searches in question. So remember, these blasts from the past. Remember, this qualified immunity, these questions don't have to be answered in any particular order. The courts can skip the question too. They can assume, just for the sake of argument, without deciding whether or not it was a constitutional violation, they can assume that it was and say, even if it was, it wasn't clearly established, and they can grant qualified immunity. And the courts tend to do that. They've been doing that a lot more, especially recently, even the Supreme Court skipping that first question and going straight to the second question of whether it was clearly established, which really never answers the first question and leaves it kind of open. There's no particular order that the questions have to be answered in. And I also want to point out an important Supreme Court case. I try and point out the Supreme Court cases here where they're significant. This is you might recall back from 2009, Michigan v. Fisher. This was an interesting case in the state of Michigan where there was a person who was acting very erratically. Police officers responded to a complaint of a disturbance at a dwelling. And when they arrived, they can see Mr. Fisher screaming inside the house. He's throwing things like glass ashtrays and in the direction, and they can't see whether or not there's another person in there that stuff's getting thrown at. But he's acting very irrationally. He's throwing things, and he's bleeding. He's bleeding significantly. They ask him if he's okay, and he tells them to go away and get a warrant. And but the officers push the door open and enter the house, and then Mr. Fisher points a gun at him. Now, the state of Michigan, they said that entering the home, they recognized that searches and seizures inside the home are always presumptively unreasonable. But the Michigan's court said that there was no exigency that applied to this situation, but the Supreme Court disagreed. And this is one of those cases of the different exigent circumstances, and exigent circumstances are a family. There's different types of exigencies, and we talk a lot about the three main types of exigent circumstances: the hot pursuit doctrine, the destruction of evidence doctrine, and the emergency exigency. And this fell under the emergency exigency, and the court said, "Hey, look, given these facts, the officers had a reasonable belief that was someone inside that needed assistance." And it, even if Fisher was saying he didn't need help, the fact that he was bleeding, and they didn't know whether or not there was a victim in there that was the recipient of his anger and the direction that they were throwing things. So that's a really important emergency exigency case for me to point out. And the court refers to it on appeal. So the first two issues, let's take the first issue of the two. Were the first two warrantless entries justified under the exigent circumstances doctrine? Now, remember, the district court had only relied on Maryland versus Bowie and did not adopt any emergency exigency arguments in the cases, that the four or five cases that were presented at that level on the motion. But on the appellate level, the circuit court held that emergency exigency justified the first two entries. They said when police are investigating what they reasonably believe to be a residential burglary, they can conduct a limited warrantless search of the house to look for potential suspects and victims. Now, this isn't a buoy sweep. It's actually under the emergency exigency. They believe that there is criminal act that's taken place, and there could very well be either other perpetrators or victims of the criminal activity inside the house. And the 11th Circuit said this comports with the Fourth Amendment's reasonableness requirement. The court said it would make no sense to compel an officer confronting a suspected burglary to quit the scene to procure a warrant, thereby jeopardizing the premises and the prospect of catching culprits and the safety of the potential victims inside. The court noted that what the Supreme Court said about the exigent circumstances situation that it considered in Michigan v. Fisher applies equally in this case. And so they held that it doesn't meet the needs of law enforcement or the demands of public safety to require the officers to walk away from a situation like the one they encountered here. So they held that the burglary itself, it actually is the exigency. The fact that they have this reasonable belief that a burglary has taken place, that it justifies a limited warrantless entry to search for suspects and victims. And so the first two, they say, yes, they were justified under the exigent circumstances doctrine. But the exigent circumstances were gone after the first two entries. In all the cases, if you've ever attended any of the training or webinars that I've conducted on exigent circumstances, regardless of which type of exigency that you're operating under, which of the types of exigent circumstances, there's one thing that's pretty much in common with all of them, and once the exigency is over, the exception is over. The exception is only valid for the limited purpose of the exigency, whatever it is. And if it's an emergency exigency, going into the house to make sure that there aren't any more victims or that there aren't any more perpetrators, that once they've gone into the house and they have done that and they know that there's no one else inside the house, then that exigency is over and it's gone. And so you can't operate under that JRE anymore. But remember the officers argued, their argument through their attorney was that the last four entries were okay under the Fourth Amendment because once the officers had gone in lawfully under the exigent circumstances, that the privacy had been destroyed, and therefore there was no longer REP, a reasonable expectation of privacy, in the premises after the first two entries. And so they could re-enter to the same extent that they had entered before without having it constitute a search. And that's what the court ruled. The court said, having approved the first and second entries, we can make quick work of Montanez's challenge to the subsequent, they're talking about the subsequent four entries, in which the officers re-entered four times to observe the marijuana and paraphernalia discovered earlier in plain sight. Said, our binding precedent makes it clear that those entries were justified, even though the exigency that underlie the first two searches had almost surely passed. And they cited one case. It's a 1977 Fifth Circuit case, which they say is binding because it was before the 11th Circuit split off the First Circuit, the Fifth Circuit. United States versus Brand is the case that the court relied on, the 11th Circuit relied on. And it was a Fifth Circuit case from 1977. Once that the interest is invaded legally by an official of the state, the citizen has lost his reasonable expectation of privacy to the extent of the invasion. So basically what they're saying is that they said accordingly, without offending the Fourth Amendment, they may enter the property once it's already been intruded upon legally. Basically what they're saying is that it's not a search because without REP under Katz versus United States, without that reasonable expectation of privacy, it's not a search under the Katz rule of law, which is true if all you are applying is Katz. And that's basically what they're doing. They're saying so what the court's basically saying is that these aren't searches and there's no REP. Now, they did not cite a Supreme Court case, but the Supreme Court case that's really good for this type of argument is United States versus Jacobson, which you can find at 104 Supreme Court 1652. Now, this case came out in 1984, and this was the case that the case with the drugs, right? The FedEx, the private entity, the private person not acting at the direction of the government opens a box and they find what believed to be drugs. And then the DEA goes back into the box to the same extent in order to do that. And then they go a little bit beyond that once they had the probable cause that it was drugs. But Jacobson is the case that says once REP is destroyed, then it's not a search under the Fourth Amendment for the government to go back in. And of course, that is purely under the rule of law of Katz. And so the court said, although they didn't refer to Jacobson, it's the rule of law that came from Jacobson. The court said that since the REP was eliminated by the first two lawful entries into the house, then the subsequent four entries did not go into any greater depth. In other words, they didn't start opening drawers and look. They didn't look anywhere that they didn't go in and look before. They just went back in to show them, to have their little show and tell of the marijuana and the paraphernalia. Since they didn't go any further than what they did in the first two lawful entries, then the subsequent entries were not searches under the Fourth Amendment. They didn't violate the Fourth Amendment. And as a result, they reversed the district court's denial of qualified immunity. They reversed the decision and they remanded the case back to the district court with instructions to grant the officers their motion on for qualified immunity on summary judgment. And that's the case. So now that we've gone through that, you know, I usually talk about Bruce's 2 cents worth. Well, today you're going to get a nickel because this case is really problematic, in my opinion, and so let me share my opinion with you. Before I do that, let me give you a couple blasts from the past. In its decision, ironically, the circuit court referenced Kentucky versus King case, which deals with destruction exigencies. In addition to that, just a brief mention of Michigan v. Fisher, they talked about the Kentucky versus King destruction exigency case. And they also talked about Graham versus Connor, which is the gold standard for the use of force cases, which is kind of interesting as well. But, you know, one case that's noticeably absent in all of the both at the district court level and at the circuit court level is Jones. The cases that they relied upon are all pre-Jones cases. You know, Jones came out from the Supreme Court, United States versus Jones, a tracking device case back in 2012. And, you know, Jones was a case that really changed Fourth Amendment jurisprudence for us because in that case, Justice Scalia, in the majority opinion, he basically resurrected the old school definition of a search that had existed prior to Katz to sit side by side and created an alternative search theory. And so even if something isn't a search under Katz, that can be a search under the physical intrusion or the trespass theory of what constitutes a search. And remember, if you have a physical intrusion by the government upon any of the four constitutionally protected areas, which are persons, houses, papers, and effects, and this physical intrusion by the government's for the purpose of gathering information, then it's a search under the Fourth Amendment, regardless of privacy interest. There's no privacy in the calculus for a Jones search. In fact, in Jones itself, it was the exterior of an automobile that they had affixed a tracking device to, and there was no REP in the exterior of the car parked in a public place, and so Katz wasn't triggered. But under Jones, they physically touched it for the purpose of gathering information, and so therefore, it was a search under Jones. You have to go through both of these analyses to say that something's not a search, and so it's just really kind of interesting. It's also interesting to note of the Michigan v. Long case deals with the concept of plain view seizures, and this came as a result of Terry for us, but also the whole concept of plain view seizures is that you can actually seize the evidence if you're lawfully present. And remember, the court said they were lawfully present on both of the first two times that they were in the house, the first two warrantless entries. The second warrantless entry is where they actually saw the contraband, and so they could have seized it under the plain view seizure doctrine. They had lawful observation, lawful access, and it was immediately recognizable as contraband, and so it could have been seized. So, you know, my little editorial comment here, I am dumbfounded by the fact that the court made absolutely no reference to Jones whatsoever. It's true. Prior to 2012, this decision would have made perfect sense because the old school definition, the Jones definition of a search, from Olmsted, actually back in 1928, had not been resurrected. From 1967 to 2012, the only definition of a search was the privacy invasion definition under Katz. But after 2012, then the destruction of REP doesn't really matter. I mean, that would be fine under Katz, but how do they get around a Jones search? Because privacy is not a part of it. They physically went into the house for the purpose of gathering information. That's a search under Jones, period. And if it's a search, it has to be reasonable. And in order to be reasonable, you have to have either a warrant or a judicially recognized exception. The JRE that they are operating under was the exigency, the emergency exigency, and that ended, according to the court, that ended after the second search. So there was no legal basis for the four subsequent entries under Jones, but it was never brought up. It was never brought up by the lower court, and it wasn't brought up on appeal, and it was never mentioned by either court, which is really, really interesting. And as a result of that, and being an attorney here in Florida, my concern is that law enforcement officers are going to latch on to this decision and think that now they can do exactly what the officers did in this case because there's precedent for it. This is a danger to LEOs. I'm going to put out a danger warning. You should really consult with your legal advisor before you make any search decisions based on this decision because it flies in the face of United States versus Jones. And I just really wouldn't recommend that you hang your hat on this one. And obviously, I don't provide legal advice. This is purely an academic environment. So if you want legal advice on this opinion, you need to consult with your legal advisor. But I would caution LEOs, law enforcement officers, in hanging their hat on this decision when it comes to reentry into the house after exigent circumstances are over, without taking Jones into consideration, it really kind of flies in the face of that Supreme Court decision. Well, that's it. I went just a couple minutes over. Went a little bit more than half an hour, but that's okay. Thanks for joining me today on this episode of Broadcast Blue. Remember, you can go to www.broadcast.blue for information regarding upcoming webinars, podcasts. You can also stream them. You can sign up. You can subscribe to Broadcast Blue. It's on iTunes and Google Play. Would very much appreciate it if you would subscribe to the podcast directly if you have a Google or an Apple device. You can also watch previous episodes. If you're listening to the audio and you want to see what you're missing from the webinar, the actual presentation that takes place along with the audio, you can go to www.brownbag.video and subscribe to our Vimeo channel, the Broadcast Blue Vimeo channel. I would also invite you to go to www.lea.one, and you can find online training opportunities that deal with the legal aspects of law enforcement. Www.lea.one, LEA1, and for on-demand e-learning courses, live webinar training, and live instruction at your site. The last week, I was very pleased to be in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Got to see the Liberty Bell, conducted some update training for the fine folks at the National Park Service there in historic Philadelphia. And next week, I will be at the wonderful National Conservation Training Center in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, providing some more live training. So we conduct live training at your site, and we also have live offerings at central sites. Like I mentioned earlier, in September 18th and 19th, we're going to have a live CLETP class at the Embassy Suites Crystal City. Join us on September 18th and September 19th for that. You can email me at bruce@broadcast.blue for more information on that as well. Again, thanks so much for joining me. I'll be coming to you again live next week with another interesting case, and I hope to see you then.